The State Legislative Redistricting Subcommittee will come to order. DJ, please call the roll.
Chair Byrd.
Here.
Vice Chair Robinson.
Here.
Ranking Member Daly.
Here.
Representatives Arrington.
Here.
Barnaby has been excused. Bell.
Here.
Brannan.
Here.
Chambliss.
Here.
Garrison.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Hawkins.
Here.
Manny.
Here.
McLean.
Here.
Mello.
Here.
Mooney.
Here.
Persons Maleka.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tant.
Here.
Valdez.
Present.
Woodson.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, DJ. And a few reminders before we begin. As I look out at an empty committee room, at least from the public's perspective, I would ask that everyone please silence all electronic devices. And if you wish to make a public comment, please fill out a form and turn it into the sergeant staff. And if somebody walks in, we'll remind them of that. Also, for members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. So good afternoon, members. Welcome back to our interim committee meetings. So far in this process, we have covered an introduction to redistricting concepts, reviewed our website and current public input opportunities, discussed our map drawing application's advanced functionality, and how those tools can assist us in aligning our maps with our constitutional standards, as well as demonstrated some tangible examples of our constitutional standards within our currently enacted House map. I explained during our first committee meeting how important a comprehensive educational effort is to understanding the full scope of redistricting. I hope you're coming to appreciate that this is not an easy task, nor one with clear-cut answers. One of the last pieces of educational information we need to cover as a committee is the legal aspect of redistricting, which includes applicable federal and state law, as well as case law related to this process, especially Florida Supreme Court precedent that was established following the 2012 redistricting cycle. This will directly impact how we view and apply our Tier 1 and Tier 2 standards. For this redistricting cycle, the House has retained outside counsel to advise the chamber on state and federal law, as well as relevant court precedent. For today's presentation, our committee will be hearing from Pete Dunbar with Dean Mead Law Firm. Pete began his public service in 1967, serving as a staff director in the Florida House, and later served as a representative from the Pinellas-Pasco County area. Pete's tenure as a state representative encompassed the 1982 redistricting cycle, and he has been additionally involved in subsequent redistricting cycles, serving as outside counsel. Members, I want to differentiate that today's council presentation is for our education on relevant redistricting law. It is not for discussing hypothetical scenarios or specific policy decisions that may come before our committee because, as I've mentioned before, there is no single correct map. When we begin reviewing district boundary lines, decisions must be weighed among one another with the goal of drawing a legally compliant map. As Mr. Dunbar goes through his presentation, I encourage you to take notes of questions you may have. Once the presentation is concluded, we will take questions from members on the contents of the presentation and will then move on to public comment. And with that, Mr. Dunbar, welcome to the House State Legislative Redistricting Subcommittee. You are recognized to present.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, members of the committee. My goal, as the chairman stated today, is to provide an overview of the basic legal standards and their hierarchy that govern the task that you will be facing. I want to do it first by looking at the federal standards. You will find them some to be previously used and some to be very relevant still today. That is the standard that was used the first four times that legislative plans went to the Florida Supreme Court, and we'll take a look at those. Then we'll look at the Florida redistricting standards that are now found in sections 21 and 22 of Article 3 of the Constitution, and they were applied for the first time in 2012, as the chairman indicated. These standards The new standards were considered and analyzed in significant detail by the Florida Supreme Court. The chair referenced that particular decision. If you're interested, it's probably worth taking a look at. It's titled In Re Senate Resolution of Legislative Apportionment. It will be cited a number of times in the slide, rather lengthy, but very much full of guidance and insight for how things are expected to be conducted. But that being said, let's start first by taking a look at some of the federal level legal and law and legal standards that have been around for a while. And I want to begin first with the Voting Rights Act that was enacted in 1965. Now, the goal here was to try and protect the mechanism, or served as a mechanism, for enforcing the 15th Amendment rights of voting rights of amendments of minority members under the Constitution, and that was the objective. The Voting Rights Act had two relevant sections that carry over to state election activities that clearly also deal with apportionment activities. The first one is found in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and it is this section that prohibits a state from imposing voting procedures or enactments that deny or abridge minority voting rights based on race, color, or language minority. There is a very significant seminal case on this that interpreted this Section 2 provision in that context. It's Thornburg versus Jingles. I will tell you that it's commonly referred to as the Jingles case, and that's the way I will refer to it from this point on. And under Jingles, basically what you find is the state is obligated to create minority opportunity districts when the minority population is large enough and is compact enough to justify such a district. When the minority population needs to be deemed to be politically cohesive, so there can't be a polarization process within the minority population. And it also looks at whether or not the minority population grouping is being taken advantage of by a larger voting population that denies the minority population the representation of their choice. In the context of the Jingles case, these elements present something to look at in the totality of the circumstances in order to make sure that Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act is complied with. I might point out here, too, one of the other things from the case is that discriminatory intent is not required to be a violation of Section 2. It is the totality of the circumstances that I just enumerated that would create a basis for a challenge to such a district. There's a second section that comes from the Voting Rights Act. Now, there's a little bit of history to this one. It is relevant for us for other reasons, but let me go through it nonetheless. It's Section 5. And its purpose was to prohibit retrogression of the positions that minority populations had attained during the electoral process. Basically, Section 5 was enacted to prevent backsliding from the prior gains that had been attained by minority populations. In order to implement this tool, there was a provision in the law, or in Section 5, that required the pre-clearance of changes to election laws and election procedures by the federal government before the changes could be implemented in certain states and in geographical areas of certain other states. And those areas were determined through a formula based on existing conditions in the 1960s and the 1970s. Now, in Florida, the formulas extended the federal preclearance requirements to the specific jurisdictions that included Collier, Hardy, Hillsborough, and Monroe counties. And in that context, when we had reapportionment plans or apportionment plans that were running through the process, preclearance was one of the objectives that needed to be overcome going through it. Now, I also want you to note the Shelby County versus Holder case that appears at the bottom of the page. And this case was decided by the United States Supreme Court in 2013. And basically, it determined that the formulas for preclearance based upon the events and activities and conditions in 1960 and in the 1970s were no longer applicable and eliminated the preclearance based on those conditions. Now, it did afford the opportunity for Congress to come in and put new formulas in place. Congress never did that. Long story short, Section 5 no longer requires preclearance by anyone, anywhere. Also being said, that doesn't mean we walk away from or don't need to pay attention to some of the criteria that have been set by the application of Article 5. Before we leave the federal area, let me talk briefly on a couple of items relating to gerrymandering. First, with regard to racial gerrymandering, the benchmark case, there are a number of them, but this is one of the key ones, is Miller versus Johnson, deals with racial gerrymandering. And it basically provides, first, that you cannot, it is improper to have the intent to create a minority district as a predominant factor when you are designing that district as a matter of general application. Race, however, may be considered and be taken into consideration as a predominant characteristic when you are competing to apply the standard to the compelling state interests that were first expressed in the Federal Voting Rights Act and we now find in the new additions to Florida's Constitution that took effect in 2012. This becomes a relevant part of your work when we look to the new Florida standards in a minute that you will find in the Tier 2 standards in the Florida Constitution. One more gerrymandering case that will of interest and note. Lita, is it Rucco? Rucho versus Common Cause. We were discussing the correct pronunciation a bit earlier. But this was the final determination that was done in 2019 with regard to political gerrymandering. Now, there was, through a series of decades, cases that attempted to apply the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause to prohibit partisan gerrymandering. But all of the prior cases before the Common Cause case were left without a final determination. In this particular case, again, very recent, 2019, it basically took the federal judiciary out of this question under the 14th Amendment by determining that political or partisan gerrymandering was beyond the reach of the federal courts, and it is a political and not a legal question. Again, when we take a look at the Florida standards, in the next series of slides, this issue arises again, but it will appear in a different context than the claims that were made in the federal courts under the Equal Protection Clause, or attempting to bring it under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. So let me first introduce you to the base standards that appeared in the 1968 version of Florida's Constitution. They are found in Article 3, Section 16, and basically, before 1968, there was no process to seek for an aggrieved party to seek an immediate or direct review of apportionment plans that followed with a proliferation of litigation. Between the years 1955 and 1966, there were no fewer than seven apportionment plans offered by the legislature, but ultimately all of them were rejected by the federal courts. As a result of this proliferation of fruitless and unproductive litigation, the provisions of Article 3, Section 16 were adopted by the voters and now mandate under that context that the legislature prepare the plans with a time certain prescribed, shown here, that the optional standards include setting the numerical membership for each of the bodies here in the legislature. By the way, that didn't previously exist as part of one of the standards in the 1885 Constitution. It did require that the districts be contiguous, so you can't just touch them with a point. There has to be a geographical continuity to that. And once adopted, to address this proliferation that was unproductive prior to the adoption of the Constitution, we're now provided an opportunity to go immediately to the Florida Supreme Court, where the goal is to provide a direct and immediate decision to to the validity of the decisions that you have made here in the Capitol on this subject. I will say that these were the standards that all of the apportionment plans that preceded 2012 were evaluated against by the Florida Supreme Court, but in 2012, the voters added two new sections to the Constitution. That would be sections 20 and 21. And their key components, the chairman mentioned a little bit earlier, they are the Tier 1 and Tier 2 components that are shown here on the slide. In making an evaluation or a consideration of these elements, if there is a conflict between the tiers, then Tier 1 standards are considered a priority over the two Tier 2 standards. For the standards within the tier, there is no priority. They are basically considered co-equal in their context. Well, I'm sure you are very much aware of these Tier 1 and Tier 2 standards. Let me just highlight them one more time before we go on to the next slides. In the Tier 1 standards, the plan may not favor or disfavor a political party or an incumbent member of the legislature. Districts' lines cannot be drawn to abridge the opportunity of racial and language minorities or diminish the ability for them to elect representatives of their choice. And districts must consist of contiguous territory. Tier 1, the priority standards. In Tier 2, the standards require that the districts be nearly as equal as practicable, that districts be compact geographically, and where feasible, the boundaries for the districts utilize or must utilize city, county, or geographical boundaries. And I was, when I was observing your last meeting, Ms. Kelly provided specific examples for all of you on how those boundaries can be identified and utilized. It is not unusual to find a bit of tension between these tiers. That's part of what you will wrestle with, but in evaluating them or dealing with the tension that might result, at least now you will, I hope, appreciate the priority on how you might evaluate that. Now, this is my first time you'll see the citation of the actual case from 2012. You might make a note on it if you'd like to read it. It is very fascinating and quite good. I'm going to try to provide some of the key highlights from the case for your benefit. So the first opportunity here would be to address the Tier 1 standards with regard to the improper intent to favor or disfavor political parties. First, with regard to the intent to favor or disfavor, there is no acceptable level of improper intent. If it's there, it's unacceptable. There is not any level for it that to be attained. But the court decision also notes that the provision speaks specifically to intent and not to effect. Said differently, the standard does not require a quote-unquote fair plan, but it requires a plan without improper intent. The court on this topic specifically rejected the suggestion that there should be an alteration to a plan after it's drawn and the effects are known, and in effect, acknowledged attempts to rebalance the plan in this fashion based on statewide voting patterns was not a standard to be found in Tier 1 or to be found in Tier 2. Next, let's take a look at the provision that provides that it is improper to favor or disfavor an incumbent when engaged in creating districts. And the court also has provided us some standards on what would bring that into play. First, districts cannot be configured with consideration towards the residents of any of you. The incumbents' residents is not a consideration that is permissible. Districts can't be created with the idea that we're not putting incumbents in the same district against each other. That's also an improper consideration. And finally, it's an improper consideration to create a district with the intent to preserve the core voting block of the incumbent's prior district. With regard to the district's in the Tier 2 standard, basically what we're doing here is I think I got myself out of order. Give me just a quick second. Well, I want to do it this way. Let me do my best to deal with it by looking at the slides. One of the things that Tier 1 standard now deals with is basically what we found in the Federal Voting Rights Act that I went through in some detail when we were looking at the federal standards. So what may no longer be a preclearance requirement under Section 5, because that's been eliminated, now finds itself embodied in Florida's Constitution in Article 3, Section 21. Said differently, I made note of a series of counties that were affected under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, but under the new standards that we find in Tier 1, it's no longer just those five counties. It is the entire state of Florida that the context of this minority opportunity or the ability to avoid prejudicial efforts in the creating of those districts. So the Tier 1 standard that we now find is basically a reiteration of what was previously found in the Voting Rights Act that we previously discussed. That gets us to the district, the Tier 2 constitutional standards. And there is a requirement that the district populations be as nearly equal as practicable. That's a carryover that we have seen in both congressional and legislative redistricting. But one of the things that is a bit unique is there is a bit more flexibility and tolerance with regard to legislative district sizes and their variance that you would find in the same context with a congressional district. So there is more flexibility allowing you to deal with some of the other standards that deal with compactness and the boundary standards that are being created. Not that it's a lot, but it is there and it is slightly different. The districts are again required to be compact, and geography is the relevant factor here. Basically, it's a visual concept, and there are recognizable mathematical tests that Ms. Kelly has previously demonstrated to you, and they include the Polsby-Potter, RIOC, and the area convex hull test, some of which were used in 2012 when the House presented its plan to the Supreme Court at that time. Now, the political boundaries are pretty obvious. They are the recognizable county and city boundary lines. The geographical boundary lines also are those things that are easily identified and recognizable, such things as major roadways, railways, rivers, and other natural water bodies. Let me conclude this way. The 2012 opinion that we focused on in some of these standards, and I hope you wrote down the citation if you would like to look at it in more detail, provide both guidance and analysis of the standards that govern and will govern the redistrict work you will be engaged in over the next few months. And I want to leave with one final thought reading from that opinion before we take a little bit of time for questions, Mr. Chairman, if that's appropriate. So if I might. From the Florida Supreme Court in 2012, a review of the House plan and the record reveals that the House engaged in consistent and reasoned approach, balancing the two-tier standards by endeavoring to make districts compact as nearly equal in population as possible, and utilizing political and geographical boundaries where feasible by endeavoring to keep county and cities together where possible. In addition, the House approached the minority voting protection provisions by properly undertaking a functional analysis of the voting strength in minority districts. The House was successfully endorsed by the court in 2012, and I think following the standards that we've been through this afternoon, the same results will be delivered to you in 2022. Mr. Chairman, if there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Dunbar, for your presentation. Members, there are two specific items that I would like to address on the record before we take questions from committee members. The first being incumbencies. I want to state very clearly that we are not and will not be using any incumbent or candidate addresses to produce these maps. The House took the same position last decade, and the Florida Supreme Court viewed that as a favorable step towards protecting against inadvertently favoring or disfavoring an incumbent, one of our Tier 1 standards. I think this is also a good point in time to very candidly say, as new district lines are workshopped and this process proceeds, there is a chance any member may be paired with a fellow incumbent in a newly created district in order to create legally compliant boundary lines. I know that that may be an intimidating thought for all members. However, that is part of the process. And as you bring comments to committee, please be mindful that I will not entertain any discussion about placing boundary lines in order to favor or disfavor a current House member or potential challengers. The second item I'd like to address is a point Mr. Dunbar touched on regarding the partisan makeup of the maps. That will come before our committee. While external third-party groups seemingly prioritize the Republican-Democrat split over the legal compliance of our boundary lines, that is not what we as legislators are charged to do. Outside of using functional analysis data to ensure our racial and language minority groups can elect a candidate of their choice, a Tier 1 standard, I want to be clear that staff nor this subcommittee will be reviewing the overall partisan split of a map at any stage in this process to help ensure we are not intentionally favoring or disfavoring a political party or incumbent. Yesterday, Chair Leek was clear that the full redistricting committee will also not be looking at the partisan split. Additionally, I would encourage you to not engage in any unplanned or planned conversations regarding such topic as it may lend itself towards a violation of the Tier 1 standards as interpreted by the Florida Supreme Court. Now I will open up for questions from committee members. Please address your questions through the chair. Members, are there any questions? All right, seeing no questions from the committee, we will now turn to public comment. Is there anyone from the public wishing to address the committee on today's presentation? All right, seeing none. Representative Woodson, you have a question for Mr. Dunbar. You're recognized through the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for this comprehensive educational effort to get us acquainted with the process. My question has to do with, I have been asked a lot of questions in my district as well. And I would like to know, do we have a time frame as to when the legislature will be going to the policy behind the maps that you will be receiving? Because I keep being asked that question in my district as well.
Sure. So I'll answer that since that is a policy question. So once the maps are presented in committee, and I would imagine that's coming sooner rather than later, but as soon as we know, the members will know. It'll be at that time that we start workshopping the maps and then get into policy discussions.
Okay. I would save the other questions for whenever you start the process.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Chambliss, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, thank you for this great presentation. I was just wondering, has there been an instance in where someone had the intent of someone has been called into question, and if there has been an instance of that, how was it determined whether or not there was any intent there?
So
a live example of
when we say an instance, Mr. Dunbar, are you familiar with a legal case in which the courts have addressed intent or interest in a in the redistricting matter?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Chambliss, I would two thoughts on that. One, that's part of what we were discussing, or the United States Supreme Court was discussing in the Thornburg case, which we now, in somewhat different context, pick up and find in the provisions of Article 3, Section 21. If you will take a look at the opinion that was appearing, you will find that the court went through a number of districts on a number of bases, and the citations that I was prioritizing on how that is evaluated is a direct result of how those districts were challenged. Now, that dealt with the both Tier 1 and Tier 2, but certainly included the issues of Tier 1 that you're looking to. So I guess that's a long answer, but the real short answer is yes, and that's what you find that the Supreme Court of Florida examined in 2012, in my opinion.
Any follow-up? Nope. Ranking Member Daly, you're recognized.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dunbar, thank you very much for the presentation. My question, I don't believe, is for you, but it's actually stepping back to the answer to Rep. Woodson's question. Mr. Chairman, so if we are to workshop maps before we have ultimately decided what policy positions we're going to take, whether it's to whether when it comes to prison population or other factors that we've raised and others have raised, if we're how are we looking at maps before we've decided how we're going to handle those policy issues, I guess is the question. Because my concern is, are we putting the cart before the horse, which I recognize is a strange analogy coming from me.
So thank you for the question. So at the end of the day, the constitutional requirements are the policy decisions that we will apply to making legally compliant maps. Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So and I certainly recognize that, and the Constitution is the binding document. But when it comes to what we are permitted to change policy-wise, given that we are the legislature, when it is not you know, in the actual Constitution, but it's statutory or it's a policy decision for us to make, that's our decision to make, right? So there are certain things that are not unconstitutional that we could be doing and could be considering as we're moving forward and doing this process. Is that correct?
I mean, members are always free to file legislation and have them go through the committee process as they, you know, if they think that the law needs to be changed. You know, the task of this committee is to apply the Constitution and the laws that currently exist in preparing these maps.
Follow up? Yes, Mr. Chair. And so, and I appreciate that. I guess my thing is, going back to it, it's not constitutionally or legally prohibited, and I'll use the prison population example again, for us to consider that when making the maps. So at what point are we as a body going to decide on those type of issues, prior to us seeing a map or after or ever, for that matter?
And I appreciate the question, and this has been brought up in the big committee and also in this committee, and I'm certain in the congressional committee several times regarding the use of the census data as it relates to prisons. But I want to make it clear that the U.S. census data does not just apply to prisons. It accounts for other group quarters. And so under Article 10, Section 8 of our Constitution, it says each decennial census of the state taken by the United States shall be an official census of the state. And then throughout Florida statutes, it repeats that the U.S. decennial census data is the official census of the state for the purposes of congressional redistricting. That is the standard, both constitutionally and statutorily, that we are going to apply to, for example, prison populations.
Follow up?
Yep.
Sorry for the back and forth, Mr. Chair. Yep. I guess, so what I didn't hear in there is that we can't take up the issue of prison gerrymandering as a consideration, as I believe 11 other states have done as they've gone through the redistricting process. So there's nothing legally prohibiting us from considering that and other factors. Is that my understanding?
So I would just correct the premise of the question that there's prison gerrymandering. We're not prison gerrymandering. We are following the state constitution and state law as it applies to prison populations. And you know, I think that's an issue you may want to take up with the you know, the U.S. Census Bureau, is how they place those individuals in a certain or where they're counted in the census. We are following state law just as we did in the 2012 census, our 2012 redistricting. Follow up.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just last point here, and it is my understanding that the Census Bureau actually provides the data that would enable us to, for example, pair up Florida State inmates as they may be to their last known addresses or anything like that. So the data actually does exist. Other states have been able to do it, even with the National Census Bureau's information.
I appreciate the discussion. I think it's an important one. The other states may use the data that way. Our state has chosen through our constitution law not to use the data that way and to break it out into, we don't use geocoding. And in fact, some states do use geocoding for their prison populations, and that may result in us violating state law and knowing where a certain person is and where they're going to vote. Follow up? Okay. Anyone else from the committee? Yep, Representative Tant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about, in regards to the districts being as nearly equal as in population as possible or practicable, what will our population deviation for districts be, and will it be uniform across all districts? Do we have we made a decision on that?
So, okay. So that, I think there's a. I'll let the staff director Kelly address that, because there may be a policy component to that. So I'll let her answer it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and there is a legal component to it as well, Mr. Dunbar. If you'd like to fill in, last decade the House had roughly plus or minus 2% in the population deviation. However, you know, obviously our state has grown by over 2.5 million people throughout this decade. So as we go and create the districts, we will have to see where that line lies. There's nothing in, whether it's state law or federal precedent, that says it has to be at a certain percentage. But as we evaluate, you know, is a county kept whole here, or perhaps a city split here, it may affect where those population limits fall. So as of right now, there's no set in stone number. And Mr. Dunbar, if you'd like to speak to the legal side of that.
Yes, Representative Tant, I think I mentioned in my presentation that there is a degree of more flexibility in variance and population groupings for legislative seats than congressional seats. And if you go all the way back to Baker versus Carr, when one person, one vote was established, that was the standard set. There have been a number of cases in the next five decades where people had challenged too big, too small. Candidly, in my opinion, Florida has always been much closer in the variance than most other states, but we have seen in other states the variance go, I believe, as high as 10% between high and low. The other thing I mentioned in my presentation, and this will be a challenge for you based on the legal standards I presented, is that you will find that there will be some tension among the standards in the different tiers. So you're asked to be compact. You're asked to follow city-county boundary lines, and you are asked to be as equal in population as practicable. And there are the kinds of issues that you will wrestle with there based on the standards provided by the Supreme Court that will end up with a variance that you then have to evaluate, is it too much and not as equal as practicable, but at the same time I protected the county boundary line, those kinds of things. So. But there is a bit more flexibility for the legislative districting.
Follow up?
Yes. Will it be a uniform percent deviation for all districts, or is it going to vary from district to district?
I'll let the staff director take that.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. It's usually identified as a range, and there's two items as well. An individual district can have a range deviation. Some may be slightly over the ideal population that we referenced, you know, a couple meetings ago, or perhaps it's slightly below. So it may be district by district, and then the overall map, so the entire state, will also have a population deviation.
Any other questions from the committee? Anyone else? right. Seeing none, we don't have any public comment cards, but I do see a few members of the public, including Representative Rizzo. If there's anybody, welcome. Anybody from the public wishing to comment on the presentation? All right. Seeing none. Member with Council's presentation today, if you have any follow-up questions, please direct them through committee staff, and we will work to get your questions answered. As to our next meeting, we will keep the committee updated as our next authorized date as we find out more details about special session and any impacts it may have on the upcoming schedule. I'd like to once again thank Mr. Dunbar for his presentation and for his service to our state. Thank you, members. This concludes our committee agenda for today, and Representative Valdez moves we rise. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.